From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the January 2026 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Codebooks, diplomats, and diamonds. Rome, the 1930s, and the Italian secret services were having extraordinary success in reading the messages sent by rival countries' diplomats from their embassies in the Eternal City. With the road to World War II still ahead, it was a time of significant geopolitical tension. The Italian government was learning the secrets of countries such as Britain and France in order to gain an advantage in international affairs. This would continue after Italy joined the war in 1940, with substantial consequences for the campaign in North Africa. In this episode, we'll hear how the Italians didn't succeed by using mathematicians or intellectuals, but with a rather more direct approach. All will be revealed by Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon. Our thanks go to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our historical documents. Now, for our first episode of this new year, we're going to have a slightly different take on the Bletchley story. We're going to be looking at the achievements of the Italian codebreakers against Britain. Now, during World War I, Italy and Britain had been allied. So, David, what was the state of play between the two countries between the wars?
Well, as you say, Italy had been an ally. It hadn't been a formal part of the Entente, as it's called, which was the UK, France and Russia. But the Italians had joined the war against Austria-Hungary on the side of the Allies, and there'd been a significant military campaign on what would now be the Italian-Yugoslav border. The Italians refer to it as the Guerra Blanca, the White War, because it was fought in the Alps, essentially. So had been allies of the UK. And indeed, Nigel de Grey, who's quite a well-known character in our story, we've mentioned him many times, he was involved with Room 40 and the breaking of the Zimmermann telegram, about which we have a separate podcast. After he'd done that in 1917, he actually went to Italy and worked with the Italians on setting up intercept stations to capture Austro-Hungarian wireless traffic in the Adriatic. So there's quite a good signals relationship at that point. But crucially, what happens fairly shortly after the war, as many people are aware, is the rise of Mussolini and fascism in Italy. Mussolini actually becomes Prime Minister of Italy in October 1922. GCNCS, meanwhile, has been founded in 1919. And basically, from 1922 onwards, relations between Italy and the UK are going to deteriorate progressively for the next 18 years until in 1940, they end up joining the Second World War on the Axis side. In the early days of GCNCS, after they're set up in 1919, their main function is to intercept and read diplomatic cable traffic. They don't really do service, as in Army, Navy, Air Force traffic, at that early period. And what we're talking about today really is diplomatic traffic. But the Italians looking at British diplomatic traffic in the same way that British were looking at Italian diplomatic traffic. And it's analogous to the Cold War of the 1950s and 60s. I see it in a similar light. You can almost argue that there's a Cold War with Italy from 1922 onwards, because there's a significant, I was going to say territorial rivalry, but it's on the British side, it's not about territory. It is on the Italian side. The point is, Mussolini has imperial ambitions. He very much wanted to reinstate something that he compared to the Roman Empire.
Yep.
He had this idea of, he called it spazio vitale, which is living space. It's exactly the same as Lebensraum for the Germans. This idea that you need other people's countries that you can then expand your population into and, you know, run the place. And his vision was focused around the Mediterranean. So he had ambitions in North Africa. As people will be aware, they'd managed to acquire a colony in Libya in 1911. But he also had ambitions to extend east as far as Saudi Arabia, west as far as Spain and Morocco, take over Greece, parts of southern France. It's crazy. Africa, down through Chad to the Nigeria direction. You know, it was limitless ambition. But in the core of all this is Mare Nostrum, is our sea, is the Mediterranean Sea, which he wanted to make an Italian lake. That's all very well. But from the UK point of view, this is a really bad idea, because in the 1860s, the Suez Canal is built. And as soon as the Suez Canal is built, it kind of becomes vital for the UK, because the Raj, the Empire in India, other British possessions in the East, previously to get there, you had to go around the Horn of Africa. So as soon as the Suez Canal is built, it becomes a major artery of communications and trade with the British Empire overseas. It's 3,500 miles quicker to go through the Suez Canal. So when Mussolini starts talking about owning the Mediterranean, that's a significant threat to that communications link. And so the British are very much concerned to keep that at bay and to make sure that their ownership of that trade route and those connections is maintained. And of course, the British have staging posts along the way. You've got Gibraltar, then Malta is a major naval base for the British. Egypt, by the 1920s, is essentially run by the British.
Yeah.
It's a nominally independent country, but Britain tells everybody what to do.
Yeah.
You go on through, after World War I, Palestine is also under British mandate. Iraq is under British mandate. So there's a huge number of bits of the empire, some of which Mussolini directly has his eye on. I mean, he wants Egypt. He would happily take Palestine as well. So from the early days of the fascist regime in Italy, there is this, well, this Cold War, this idea that these two powers are competing for influence, for space. And one of the things that happens in 1922 is the signing of the Washington Naval Treaty. It's an arms control treaty intended to keep the size of the major powers' fleets within manageable proportions. And the countries that sign that, there's Britain and the USA and Japan and France and Italy. And Italy is crucial from a British point of view because Mussolini starts to build a very up-to-date navy. He's got brilliant ships. Unfortunately, they don't have the personnel and traditions that the older navies have, so they're still a little bit behind in the race, but they're a significant threat. And we talk at Bletchley Park a lot about GCNCS's interest in Germany and the idea of Nazi Germany being a target and a threat to the UK. But actually, through the 20s and most of the 30s, Germany isn't really a big deal. Italy is a much bigger concern for the British. And the thread that runs through British code breaking in the 20s and 30s really is firstly Italian and secondly naval, because they're the big stories, but also diplomatic. The other point to be made, which makes this situation worse from the UK to a certain extent, is oil. I mean, say politics nowadays, it's all about oil.
It hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed. The crucial thing that had changed in World War I, battle fleets run on coal. So the Royal Navy has an inexhaustible domestic supply of fuel. You know, Britain's never going to run out of coal. But by 1930, the Royal Navy is running on oil, which you can't get in the UK.
No.
And by World War II, nearly 50% of Royal Navy oil is coming from Persia, coming from Iran, from the Persian Gulf. So APOC, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, is a very significant player in it. So it's interesting that the Navy are protecting the trade route through Suez to the Gulf to protect the British access to oil, but it's that very oil that the Navy need in order to protect the route. It's a kind of circular thing.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Italians getting in the way of that is going to be a major concern.
Okay, can you go into a bit more detail about the Italians then? Who's responsible for their code-breaking and their intelligence? Have they got a similar setup to GCNCS?
They have. Basically, they're trying to do the same thing from the other end. They're interested in British diplomatic telegrams and messages. After the First World War, they had a number of personnel who'd worked in signals intelligence during the First World War, with Nigel de Grey, in fact. And I need to apologise to our Italian-speaking listeners at this point, because I am going to butcher the pronunciation of a lot of Italian words and names in the course of this.
I'm sure they'll let you off.
But we'll just have to live with that. They have what's called the Ufficio Informazioni, which is the intelligence office of the Ministry of War. And this is based in Rome. And this is known from 1921 as the Sezione R, or Section R. R standing for Rome, basically.
Oh, right, okay.
Basically means the Rome office, if you like. It's a typical intelligence, meaningless name for something. It's like GCNCS in the early days. It's quite a small operation. Their actual code-breaking and signals intelligence portion. And they're based in a villa on the Via Poli in Rome. I looked this up on Google Street View. It's still there. Just round the corner from the Trevi Fountain, actually.
Really?
You go, if you're standing in front of the Trevi Fountain, you go left a bit and down a road. It's just down there. And they had a couple of floors in this building. And they were doing code breaking and signals intelligence in a similar way to the British and to the Germans and everybody else. Once Mussolini comes to power, he reorganizes the intelligence services. Dictators always like good intelligence services. They always fiddle about with them. And the SIM is created in 1925. This is the Servizio Informazioni Militari, which is the military intelligence service of the Italian government. They occupy a place called Fort Bracci. And Fort Bracci is one of a ring of forts that were created around Rome in the 19th century. You know, Paris has similar forts. You know, the Portsmouth has similar forts.
Yeah.
Big 19th century thing. But one of these was taken over as the headquarters for the Italian intelligence services. And they're actually still there. The current Italian intelligence service is still in Fort Bracci. They had what we call a Y station. They had intercept stations at Fort Bracci, but they had them in other places around Italy as well. So they were building up an interception capability in the same way that the British were. The intercepted material continues to flow to Sezione R in Via Poli, and they do the decryption. The boss man of this whole organization is a chap called Vittorio Gamba, who was a First World War cryptographer and had actually written books, publicly published books about cryptography. So he's...
Really?
Yeah. In the 20s and 30s, loads of people wrote books about cryptography. William Friedman wrote a book about cryptography. The techniques aren't necessarily that secret.
There's the
famous America's Black Chamber as well.
Yes, Black Chamber. I can't remember.
You have this small cryptographic unit. You have a service doing interception. And so they're pretty well set up. What's striking about the SIGINT operation that the Italians are running is that the most successful part of it is that dealing with diplomatic messages, both cable and wireless. And it's estimated that this section was reading between 70 and 90% of diplomatic traffic sent from Rome.
Really?
Huge swathe of material. We have a list of the countries that they were interested in and they were reading traffic from. And it's a really long one. I mean, I can read you.
Yeah.
France, Switzerland, Yugoslavia, the Vatican, Spain, Portugal, Romania, Turkey, several countries in South America, and of course the UK, France, USA, and the Soviet Union. So right across the board. We'll come back to this as well, but what's interesting is a lot of the British documentation that I read doesn't mention the success against the US and the UK.
Right.
But there are reasons for that, which will become clear. But yes, they are extremely successful against diplomatic traffic.
Okay, 70 to 90%. That begs the question, were the codes really poor or were they just very good at their job or is it a combination of both?
It's actually a combination of neither.
Okay.
It's a much more direct, straightforward solution. Basically, they stole the codes.
Oh. I hadn't thought of that.
It's a pretty direct approach. How this happens is there's a Carabinieri officer by the name of Manfredi Talamo. Manfredi Talamo will play a big part in our story today. He was a Carabinieri officer who was posted to the counter-espionage section of SIM in 1933, but he went from counter-espionage to espionage because he set up an outfit called the Sezione Prelevamento, which basically translates as removal section.
That's in burglars.
Burglars. And it translates as P squad, basically. We will talk about the P squad. And what we're talking about is this Sezione Prelevamento. Basically, he got a team of another 12 Carabinieri NCOs, and he allocated each of them a foreign embassy in Rome. The Americans interviewed a lot of these people after the war. So we have a list of all of the individual NCOs and whose embassy they were responsible for. And I can read you the list. We have Alberto Perini and Francesco Pacifici. They were specifically in charge of the British Embassy. Arturo Corazza was responsible for the French Embassy. Francesco Perozzi was in charge of the German and Japanese embassies. Angelo Farsati was in charge of the Romanian delegation. Nicola Russo for the Finnish delegation. And Angelo Roldo of Spain and Sweden. How they worked was all of the foreign embassies in Rome, and this continues in embassies to this day, all embassies around the world hire local staff to do menial jobs, junior roles within their organizations. It's much cheaper to hire a local person than to send another diplomat from your home country. So the British Embassy, for example, had a number of personnel who were local Italians who were hired and worked in the embassy. And also, the fact is that there's quite a high turnover of diplomats. They will come for a tour of a couple of years, and then they'll go back to their home country or they'll be posted to a different country, whatever. Whereas these locally hired staff tend to be, in some cases, they become almost permanent members of staff because they're local and they stay there for, you know, ambassador after ambassador. It's the same.
Especially if they're domestic staff. Yeah, like that. You know,
what the Carabinieri guys did was they simply worked their way through all of the Italian junior staff in the embassies, working out which ones could be bribed, blackmailed, corrupted, persuaded to work for the Italian intelligence service. And they were extremely successful at this. Again, interviews after the war revealed that they had managed to recruit staff in, I give you a list again, the Argentine, Portuguese, Swiss, French, Turkish, Japanese, Swedish, various Balkan, British and US embassies. So basically, they've got their own men, it's mostly men, in all of these embassies. And what they're doing is they're getting these people to borrow keys so they can be copied, sometimes actually borrow or steal documentation, but also work out the patterns of life and the routines of the diplomats so that they know when the embassy is going to be empty, when it's going to be busy, all these sorts of things. The chap who was responsible for the British embassy, Alberto Perini, did exactly this. He recruited another chap called Francesco Costantini to work for him inside the British embassy. Costantini is quite an interesting guy. He came to Rome in 1908 as a 14-year-old boy and got a job in the US embassy as an office boy. So you've got this Italian teenager running around the US embassy. Rather amusingly, he was sacked for fighting by the Americans in 1917. So he's presumably beating up one of the other office boys. However, this doesn't prevent the British embassy from recruiting him to their staff.
Oh, well, we like him.
So he got a job in the British embassy. You know, the First World War is still going on at this point. So by the time you get to the 1920s, Francesco Costantini has become a fixture in the British embassy, if you like. He does sort of security duties, a doorman. He helps out with sort of running errands, things like that.
Okay.
He's a general fixer and helper. If you want a ticket to the opera, you go and ask Francesco and he'll sort it out for you.
Right, okay.
He's basically made himself useful to everybody in the embassy. And in 1920, he becomes officially a chancery servant, which is a post that is a support role for the ambassador and the other senior staff. He more or less has the run of the place because he's trusted. Interestingly, he was actually interviewed by an Italian magazine in the 1950s and he gave a version of what happened. You have to take his version with a bit of a pinch of salt because it's described by him. But we also have interrogation information from Carabinieri personnel after the Italian armistice. The British intelligence went in and talked to everybody. So you can corroborate some of Costantini's stuff with other sources. So you don't have to rely entirely on his unreliable memoir. He described in particular the fact that telegrams would arrive from London in the embassy in Rome. They'd be taken down by hand by somebody. Then the transcript of the message would be handed to a typist who then type it up neatly on a piece of paper to go to the ambassador. The original handwritten copy would then just go in a basket and every other day they would get burned. And one of Francesco's responsibilities was to go down to the furnace in the basement and burn the messages. But encouraged by his Italian handlers, what he worked out was if he went down in the basement and he pre-filled the furnace with damp straw, so when he fired it up, the entire basement filled with fairly noxious smoke. The British diplomat who was supposed to supervise him was basically driven out into the corridor because you couldn't breathe in there.
Right.
Yeah, the place was thick with smoke. Costantini goes, don't worry, you go stand in the corridor, I'll get this done. What he's doing is actually hiding the decrypts in a basket in the back of the basement, just burning rubbish and coming out and going, that's all done then, see you tomorrow, kind of thing. And then he's taking the decrypts he's hidden in the corner home with him at the end of the day, passing them on to the Carabinieri. Off we go. Italians are reading the ambassador's cables pretty much daily. He's copied keys to the building, so he has access to places. He borrows documents. In one case, in his memoir, he described borrowing a full set of British diplomatic ciphers, handing them over to the Carabinieri, and as he put it, nervously drinking and smoking for 7 hours through the night while these documents were photographed. Because, of course, he had to get them back in the morning before anyone came to work. So he's handed them over to someone else, and he then has to sit there. Fortunately, the Carabinieri come back and go, here you go, and give him the code books back, and he takes them back to the embassy, and no one is the wiser. In his memoir, he claims that he did this out of his Italian patriotism, and that I gained no fortune, no material or even moral recognition. However, other paperwork shows that he was being paid 4,000 lire a month by the Italian intelligence service. So maybe he wasn't just quite as patriotic as he claimed. Interestingly, it was also discovered in the early 1990s when the Soviet archives were briefly opened after the end of the Cold War, that he was selling the same material to the Soviets, to the OGPU.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And they were paying him $5,000 a month. So,
oh, he's quits in there.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in 1931, he got the sack. So that was the end of that. He wasn't found out for what he was doing. He was sacked for another disciplinary offence I don't know anything about. But it wasn't connected to him stealing things. It was just he got into trouble for some reason.
Probably another fight.
But the Italian intelligence service weren't discouraged because before he got sacked, Francesco Costantini had managed to get a job for his little brother Secondo Costantini in the same embassy. So little brother Secondo comes in and carries on supplying material.
Really?
Initially, Secondo provides material to his big brother Franco, who then passes it to the Italians and sells it to the Soviets. But again, he loses his job because both SIM and the Russians figure out that he's actually only the middleman. He's little brother who's doing the work. So they go straight to little brother, and Francesco is kind of pushed to one side. Secondo continues to spy in the British Embassy, and he carries on what were described as operations in the British Embassy right up until 1940, when war breaks out and diplomatic relations are closed. Mm. So he loses his job at that point as well. We will hear from him again. Two things are happening here. One is that the SIM, the Italian codebreakers, are able to obtain decrypts directly from the ones that aren't burnt in the basement. They've also been given copies of the Foreign Office confidential cipher, known as the R code.
Oh.
They've got copies of the codebook as well that they photographed. So if there's traffic they can't get the decrypt of, they can decrypt it themselves anyway because they've got the codebook. So basically, British communications to the embassy are pretty much an open book. And this isn't just the British embassy, it's half a dozen embassies in that list
I gave you.
As I said at the outset, it doesn't involve any clever cryptography or Oxbridge geniuses. It just involves some bundles of cash and some burglars. I mean, it helps that all these embassies are in your capital city, literally round the corner from your SIGINT office.
At the League of Nations, a grave disturbance. Today, Haile Selassie comes to plead for his lost empire. He wants them to make Mussolini give up Ethiopia. The Geneva crowds are for him, but the exiled emperor will need his imperturbable dignity before the day is over. British Foreign Minister Eden, Soviet delegate Litvinov on the left, and French Premier Blum and all the statesmen, instead of helping Haile Selassie, have decided to lift the sanctions against Italy. The introduction of the emperor in English. In the shadows of the press gallery, Italian newspaper men are ready for an outbreak against the emperor whose country their country has taken, waiting for his first words.
Monsieur le Président. Monsieur le...
Trying to quell the disturbance, lights turned out. Again, lights out. The disturbers ejected, arrested, and he is able to make his appeal. An ovation, yes, but he gets no help. The League lifts the sanctions against Italy. Applause, and that's all.
If the Italians have got such a bead on the British codes, did they have any inkling of what was going on, the British? Did they know their codes were being broken? What did they do about it? Or didn't they know?
Well, it's not so much did they know. We know what they did or didn't do about it. Whether that was based on them not knowing, I think it's better to see it as them not so much not caring as being unduly confident and arrogant of their own security. They didn't really believe that they were vulnerable. And this is where the story takes a turn that I think makes it start to sound like a kind of crime caper movie, that it's not till 1936. So the Italians have been in there for 16 years at this point. I mean, Francesco Costantini started in 1920. So years and years and years of this. The cat gets out of the bag in 1936 because the British ambassador in Rome and his family had been to a function. And on returning from the function, the ambassador couldn't be bothered to put his daughter's diamond necklace in the safe. So he simply locked it in a dispatch box in his office. He came back in the morning and the necklace had been stolen from the dispatch box.
Okay. These are like the red boxes.
Like the red boxes you see on budget day.
Yeah.
That's a dispatch box, yeah. And, you know, people at the Carabinieri office must have been slapping their foreheads and going, why the hell did you do that? You know, but clearly whoever it was burgling the British ambassador's office that night was unduly tempted, shall we say. you know, you're stealing all these boring papers and then you see a
diamond necklace. Yeah.
You go, oh, yeah, I might just have that. But of course, you know, that's something the ambassador can't really ignore.
No.
So this gets reported back to London. And the people who are responsible for Foreign Office, Diplomatic Service Security overseas are the Secret Intelligence Service, SIS. And in particular, Section 5, which is the security section of SIS. And there's a man there called Valentine Vivian, who was head of counterintelligence in Section 5 of SIS. And he is asked to investigate and find out what's going on. So he travels to Rome and he is frankly horrified because he gets there and he finds out that the place is a security nightmare for all the reasons we've described. And he wrote a report where he points out a number of security breaches. For example, he notes that these red boxes, the dispatch boxes, which were supposedly secure, the keys were routinely taken home by members of staff and left lying around their houses where their domestic servants could indeed just press them into a bar of soap and copy them. To secure the keys to the dispatch boxes, there was a combination locked safe in one of the offices where you could lock up all the keys for the dispatch boxes. But Vivian opened one of the dispatch boxes and tucked inside it was a piece of paper with the combination for the key safe. You know, this is the level of security incompetence we're talking about. He also pointed out that every day at lunchtime, all of the British staff left the building to go for lunch. And the embassy was routinely left empty, both at lunchtimes and at night, and guarded by one Carabinieri officer. There's one Italian in charge of the building. And Vivian describes this man as more of a menace than a safeguard.
Great.
And you have to imagine that Manfredi Talamo, who's in charge of all this, literally, you know, if he turned up at the right time of day, he could just walk up to that building.
Yeah.
And the only person there would be one of his own people who let him in and he could roam around as much as he liked. And he had all the keys. It's a complete disaster. What Vivian recommends is they say, sack all the Italian security. Get what he described as three reliable British ex-servicemen to take over security. And, you know, at least have somebody on the door who's just not going to let anybody in. He also discovered he went to the embassy press officer's office. One of his roles was to talk about British foreign policy. So he was getting regular documents containing details of what British policy was and different things. He kept these in a locked cabinet where if you took a screwdriver and took six screws out of the hinges, you could just take the door off. So those were regularly being stolen. Vivian actually saves his particular condemnation for Secondo Constantini, the younger brother, who Vivian immediately sees as a wrong'un.
Oh, right.
And he calls him out in particular as someone who should be sacked immediately.
Secondo Costantini has been employed in the Chancery for 21 years. He might have been directly or indirectly responsible for any or all of the thefts of papers or valuables which have taken place or are thought to have taken place from this mission. I am clear in my mind that the circumstances of the loss of two copies of the R code from a locked press in the Chancery in 1925 point towards Secondo or his brother or both as the culprits.
So after this damning report from Vivian then, I imagine the Foreign Office and the ambassador in Rome spring to life.
No.
Ah.
They do nothing.
Why?
Because they live in a bubble of comfortable arrogance, I think would be the way to describe it, that surely this isn't happening and I'm sure things aren't that bad and, you know, we're perfectly fine. You know, don't worry about it, chaps. Even though the permanent undersecretary at the Foreign Office, a chap called Robert Van Sittart, has signed off on all the recommendations, this is not unusual in the British government. You have an inquiry, it comes up with recommendations, the government goes, thank you very much, and then does nothing.
Yeah.
We've heard this before, you know, even today. So it's not terribly surprising, but it smacks of a deep level of complacency in the Foreign Office. You know, they're only Italians, what could they possibly do? When in fact they've been completely penetrated. In fact, Vivian went to the embassy in Berlin after this, because he was like, you know, how far does this go? And he said Berlin was as bad. He wrote a report there saying, you know, they were letting, you know, Germans do security. So it's endemic within the Foreign Office. And the Italians are just exploiting it. But also, not only is it endemic in the Foreign Office, but it's endemic throughout the embassies in Rome. The diplomatic community is living in a naive bubble, and actually all their offices are being burgled by Italians on a weekly basis.
Now, all of this is pre-war.
Yes.
So does it have that much of an effect? Because we're not actually at war with Italy at the time.
It does have an effect in terms of Britain's standing in the world and their relations with Italy. And as I say, you have this Cold War going on where successes aren't necessarily rated in terms of, you know, physical gains or military gains. It's more about reputational standing in the world and getting one over on the other power. Mm. You know? So it certainly does significant damage. It's during the Abyssinian crisis that this really comes to the fore. The Abyssinian crisis is in 1935, Mussolini decides to invade Ethiopia, kick out Emperor Haile Selassie and take over Ethiopia as an Italian colony. And British naval intelligence and GCNCS are able to pick up naval movements and Italian activity that shows that an invasion of Ethiopia is potentially imminent. And the whole thing goes to the League of Nations, and there's a major diplomatic situation, if you like, in 1935, 1936, where other powers within the League of Nations, the UK and France, for example, they're leaning on Italy to say, you know, this is expansionist nonsense and you shouldn't do it. And ultimately, sanctions are placed on Italy, economic sanctions are placed on Italy, but they're not really very effective. And in the end, Mussolini goes ahead and invades Ethiopia anyway. And as a consequence of that, both Britain and France are made to look diplomatically quite weak and militarily quite weak in the sense that they can't impose their will on Italy. Mussolini has just gone, stuff you, I'm going to do it anyway. So that's kind of a diplomatic defeat for the UK. And actually, it's one of the nails in the coffin of the League of Nations, because the League of Nations, having been set up after World War I as this vision of international peace, for listeners who are not familiar with this, it's like the UN before the war, but less effective, if you like.
Well, it's suggested by the US President Wilson, and then the US never join it, which puts it on back foot from the very start, doesn't it?
Yeah, and Mussolini leaves it fairly shortly after. But one of the things that comes out later, once the Italians have been defeated in the war, the former SIM member, Captain Orlando Negri, was interviewed by the British about the successes of the SIM in the pre-war period. And he claimed that when Anthony Eden went to Rome in 1935 to discuss the Abyssinian crisis with Mussolini,
right,
to try and exert British diplomatic pressure on Rome, he was kept waiting outside Mussolini's office. And at the time, they thought this was just Mussolini, you know, trying to assert himself and be rude to the, you know, sort of snub the British Foreign Secretary. The story from Orlando Negri was that Mussolini was actually reading a dossier of up-to-the-minute British diplomatic telegrams before he let Anthony Eden in. So he had a complete background on what Eden was going to say and, you know, obviously gave him a massive advantage in the negotiation because the British diplomatic traffic was a sort of open book to him. Where it gets worse after that was that the British government looked into what they should do about Abyssinia, potential invasion of Ethiopia. And they reached a couple of conclusions. One was there wasn't much they could do about it. But the things they could do, I mean, they could have gone to war with Italy in the Mediterranean, but that's not an outcome anybody wants.
No.
You know, you don't want to go to war if you don't have to. But equally, if the Italians did invade Ethiopia, would that really matter to Britain? And they came to the conclusion that it wasn't worth the gamble, you know, that ultimately if the Italians got away with it, so what? And there was a thing called the Maffei Report, a confidential report within the British government was written. And it concluded, no such vital British interest is concerned in and around Ethiopia as would make it essential for His Majesty's government to resist an Italian conquest. That's basically the British government going, we're not bothered.
Yeah.
Which is not the public face they're putting out. No. They're trying to publicly dominate the Italians and say, you mustn't do this. You know, this is terribly bad. But behind closed doors, they're going, we don't really care. The Italians get hold of a copy of the report and they put it in the paper. They make it public.
Oh, well.
And it's a massive embarrassment for the British government. They're just made to look like idiots, really. But of course, the question immediately asked is, how did the Italians get the report? And nobody suspects the Rome embassy. And the Italians put up all sorts of smoke screens about having got it through the French and one thing or another. They spread all sorts of disinformation about how they've got hold of this document. But it shows that the penetration they have of British diplomatic communications with Italy does have consequences. I mean, they're peacetime consequences, not wartime consequences. So they're of a different magnitude. You know, people aren't getting bombed as a result. But in terms of Britain's diplomatic status and its foreign policy towards Italy, it's a disaster.
La dichiarazione di guerra è già stata consegnata agli ambasciatori di Gran Bretagna e di Francia.
Now, unlike the British ambassador in Rome, we know that the place is like a sieve, but that embassy is going to close once war is declared between Italy and the UK. So does that change the situation?
Well, it should have, in the sense that if the UK no longer has a diplomatic mission in Rome, there's nothing for the Italians to burgle. But you have to remember that the UK has two diplomatic missions in Rome. There's the one to Mussolini's government, but we also have a minister plenipotentiary at the Vatican.
Oh, of course, yes.
This is a bit of a weird one because diplomatic relations with the Pope were broken off by Henry VIII back in 15-whatever. But in 1914, relationships with the Catholic Church and with the Pope had become cordial enough from the UK for them to send a representative to the Vatican. He wasn't called an ambassador because we didn't officially have diplomatic relations with the Vatican. So he's a minister and he leads a legation, but he's effectively an ambassador. So you have the wonderfully titled Sir Francis Darcy Osborne, who was minister to the Vatican from 1936 to 1947, so right through the war. And he has a separate sort of miniature embassy, if you like, in the Vatican. Once the war breaks out, the British embassy in Rome to the Italian government closes, those diplomats go home. But the one in the Vatican stays open. And one of the problems this causes for Osborne and his staff is that he then can't leave the Vatican. So they have to stay within sort of papal premises. They move into one of the Pope's guest houses. And he basically stays holed up in the Vatican dealing with the Pope through the war. And this is an important role because those of you that listened to our previous podcast about the Holocaust will know that the intelligence that's being fed through Catholic priests in occupied territories and Vatican codes and all of this, it's an important role being in contact with the Vatican. Unfortunately, the British legation in the Vatican had been penetrated in the same way that all the other diplomatic missions in Rome had been penetrated. Again, after the armistice, an Italian was interviewed by the British. It's another Carabinieri officer called Maresciallo Greffi, and he personally targeted the British legation. And he claims that between 1940 and 1943, between 6 and 8, what he calls operations, were launched against the Vatican legation. So they were able to steal copies of telegrams. They were able to steal code books. They had the keys to the building. You know, the same story all over again. Also, one of the people he suborned in the legation was interviewed by the British in 1944. This was a chap called Livio Moratti, who was a footman in the legation. He'd been recruited in early 1942. And this was useful to the Italians because he had the keys to the Chancellor's safe, where, as he put it, he borrowed cipher books in red covers, as he described them, which was probably the diplomatic cipher K, which was another Foreign Office cipher system. He passed them to Carabinieri, got them an hour later, presumably having been photographed, popped them back in the safe, all as well. And of course, these code books get updated periodically. And so he repeated this operation at least twice more in 1942.
Right.
Apparently, the Carabinieri promised him 20,000 lire per trip, so to speak. So he was quite happy to do it. But rather cannily, the Carabinieri told him that these payments would be kept by the SIM on his behalf up until after the war, at which point he would get a big payout. So he didn't actually get any money at the time. But one of the documents that really stood out to me when I was doing this research is a Foreign Office document from August 1943, which describes the consequences of this penetration of the legation.
It is understood that about 3 months ago, Sir Darcy Osborne, when in audience with the Pope, was told in the strictest confidence that the Italians were certainly reading his cipher communications with the British Foreign Office. The Pope naturally insisted that under no circumstances should he make any references to this matter in his telegrams home. At about the same time, Osborne met at a dinner party an Italian lady very close to Ciano, the Italian foreign minister, who in conversation quoted phrases which were identical with some of those Osborne had used in his telegrams home on the same subject.
That has to be pretty unique, to be told that your codes have been broken by the Pope.
It is pretty spectacular, isn't it? When the Pope leans in and confidentially says, you want to check your telegrams, mate. I mean, that is, it's extraordinary. As I say, when I came across it, I was just like, that is mad.
I think when I said sieve earlier, I think I was right.
Yeah, I mean, it must have come as a shock to Sir Darcy Osborne as well, to be told this. And he was able to get back to London in April 1943. And in his words, he took the matter up with the Foreign Office. But it's the Foreign Office. They reassured him. They said, look, you use one-time pads for your telegrams, which indeed he did. And as we've discussed on this podcast before, one-time pads correctly used are unbreakable. And so the Foreign Office confidently said that the cryptanalytical break of his telegrams was out of the question. That assumes that someone hasn't simply taken the one-time pad out of your safe and photographed it.
Oh, yes. Oh, God.
Which, of course, is exactly what happened. But even then, when that possibility was raised, they wrote another report, like the Foreign Office does, got to write a report, and the report concluded that the possibility of physical leakage or compromise at the Holy See has been investigated and is considered extremely remote. So clearly there was nothing wrong in Rome. Whereas it's very likely that his one-time pads have simply been photographed. MI6 and the Foreign Office have to explain this somehow. And so basically that blame flows downhill. And there's a diplomat who was the courier for the one-time pads who took them via Spain to Italy to deliver them to the Vatican. And they decide, oh, he must have, you know, left them in his hotel room in Spain or something. Oh. And they've been intercepted at that point.
Okay.
Because they're, I've written in my notes here, the term institutionally reluctant to face the situation. And it's exactly that, you know, in a way, the breach is so massive that it becomes kind of unthinkable. You're like, surely we can't be in that much trouble. Because as soon as you acknowledge you are, the whole thing comes crashing down, yeah. You know, you can imagine how there's just the people in London, they can't face the truth, basically. It's too horrifying.
I suppose in a way, it's similar in the way to the fact that very, very few people in Germany ever thought that Enigma could be broken. Because if it could be broken, then they knew everything was damaged.
Yeah, then that's it. Yeah.
Now, as for today's taking of the Great Abbey of Monte Cassino on Monastery Hill, this was an enormously hard-won triumph for Polish troops against an enemy from whom they had suffered much. In the mountain heights through which the Poles broke to get round the back of the ruined monastery fortress, fighting had been severe in the extreme. Men fought till they dropped exhausted, or dropped killed or wounded. They had to get through appalling mountain tracks, with the Germans commanding them and pouring streams of fire upon them at every move. The Poles were counterattacked time after time when they gained a height, and there was, all the time, no way up to the hill positions except by mule and finally on foot. Always the supply, ammunition and water parties had to go up through heavy German fire. In many positions, you could by day remain alive only in a hole in the ground. To show yourself and move in daylight in these forward positions was death. I was at a Polish headquarters on the morning of the capture when the news came through. We're in the Abbey. Monastery Hill is occupied. It was a historic moment, and the drama was heightened when an officer put the good news right in front of my eyes. He handed me a small piece of paper. It's come from the monastery by one of our carrier pigeons, he said. And I looked at the crumpled scrap of paper. All that was on it was one large V for victory, drawn in pencil. And it was signed by a lieutenant of signals who had reached the Abbey.
What does this persistent refusal to face the facts that their codes are being broken and their offices are being broken into tell us about British communication security, or ComSec, in the 30s and 40s? Do they learn lessons from this?
I'm not sure they do. It's interesting, a lot of the focus in the Bletchley Park story is on the Germans, and we talk about their sort of arrogance or their naivety or their institutional inability to acknowledge that their systems are being broken. But I always take the view that, you know, this is not a unique phenomenon in Germany. No. All governments, to a certain extent, have this inertia, this inability to face bad news, to respond to these kinds of problems. Because if you're told your codes are hopelessly compromised, then you've got to change them worldwide. You know, it's a big deal. Nobody wants to be the guy that say the whole system is broken, we've got to change it.
And we know that from the history of the British naval codes in World War II,
exactly,
don't we?
Yes. But the other thing that's interesting is, even after the Italian armistice in September 1943, and particularly later in summer 44, Rome famously falls the day before D-Day, on 5th of June 1944. Much the annoyance of Mark Clark, who's just liberated it, and he doesn't get on the front page because of D-Day. That's another story. The Italian intelligence service has a problem in 1943 that after the armistice, they are in a real cleft stick. Are they best sticking with the Germans? Do they defect to the Allies? You know, they're in a bit of a tight spot, really. And ostensibly, they have a plan of basically destroying everything. And Italian historians struggle because a huge quantity of Italian intelligence documentation from the period was simply burnt. But quite a lot of it was also buried in someone's garden, which is quite cool. So the British and the Americans were able to recover a certain amount of documentation. And also they managed to capture, or Italian intelligence personnel come and surrender themselves to the British or the Americans and say, you know, I don't want to get strung up by the Nazis, so can I come and confess to you? You know, so a lot of the information I found in the archives comes from these 1944, 1945 interrogations of people, documentary recoveries, all the rest of it. But these prisoners or these interviewees are very careful to talk about all of the other embassies they burgled, but they kind of leave out the bit about the British and the American embassies. They say, oh yeah, we did the Bulgarians and the French and the this and that and the Russians and whatever, but they don't mention the British.
We probably don't want to if you've just been captured by the British, yeah, exactly. Really, yeah.
And the British and the Americans are surprisingly uncurious about this. They're quite happy to take this at face value. So, oh no, we didn't burgle your embassy. So, oh, okay, fine. I can quote from a report produced in 1945 by the Foreign Office, where it says, much of the success of the section, he's talking about the peace squad, basically, much of the success of the section was due to the fact that many photostat code books were supplied by the espionage service. It is significant that no traffic was read of Great Britain and Russia and only a little from the USA, which is just rubbish.
How many times do they need telling?
The same report, you go to sort of the conclusions on page 14 of the report. It has countries listed one after another with the level of Italian penetration of their systems, right, their ciphers. And you get to Great Britain and it says, nothing read due to good codes and cipher security.
It's a stuck record, isn't it?
It is a stuck record. The evidence was there for the finding, but they don't want to see it. How much it matters at the end of the day, the Italians are forced into an armistice, the Allies win the war, but you go back through the 1930s, you can look at British foreign policy towards Italy in the Abyssinian crisis, in the Spanish Civil War. There are public foreign policy failures. And if the fact that the Italians can read all your diplomatic codes is contributing to those failures, then that is all creating the climate that builds up to World War II. So you can see that it's not a good thing. But at the same time, the inability to recognise the problem or to try and fix the problem is really quite surprising. Or maybe it shouldn't be surprising, but...
Well, on the other foot, you know, Bletchley Park wouldn't have been so successful if the Germans hadn't.
Well, this is it, but there is definitely a left-hand, right-hand, because on the one hand, you've got GC and CS successfully doing this to everybody else. And on the other hand, you've got the Foreign Office somehow thinking that it's immune from this process and that it can't happen to us.
This is Godfrey Talbot speaking from Rome. I'm standing in the middle of the Piazza Venezia, and at this moment, the windows of the balcony of the Palazzo Venezia, from which Mussolini was to make his speeches, the windows have been opened, and has come out onto the balcony. Not Mussolini, who incidentally has never made any appearance on that balcony since July of last year, not Mussolini, but three Allied soldiers, with their steel helmets on and their rifles in their hands. Beside them, two Romans, two people who've gone up from this square, two of the Italian people, and those four are standing there and they're waving the Italian and the Allied flags. A vastly different scene from the ones which that balcony has staged in the past.
Do we know what happened to some of these somewhat spectacular Italian burglars post-war?
We do, and in some cases it's not a very happy story. That the man who headed the peace squad, the mastermind of this whole operation, as we said at the beginning, was a Carabinieri officer called Manfredi Talamo. And Talamo did not live to tell the tale, because one of the things he was able to do was to identify in 1942 a German double agent called Kurt Saurer, who was working in the German embassies in Rome and passing material to the British.
Oh, right.
Through the Swiss military attaché. And you'd think that the Germans would be pleased that, yeah, there a double agent had been found. But of course, if you're a Nazi, your reaction to that is embarrassment, because one of your people has been shown to be a traitor. And so the head of the German security police, the Sicherheitspolizei in Rome, a chap called Herbert Kappler, very nasty piece of work, his reaction to Talamo unmasking this German double agent was to develop a lasting hatred for Talamo.
Right.
Because he's made the Germans look bad. Jump forward to October 1943. Talamo was arrested by the Germans. He is imprisoned and repeatedly tortured by the Germans, even though he spent the last few years working for them. But then around that time, in late 1943, the post-armistice Italian resistance set off a bomb in a street in Rome and killed a number of SS police who were marching down the road at the time. And the SS response to this was reprisal killings. And so they decided to basically kill 10 people for every German that had been killed. So with 33 Germans dead, they needed 330 Italians. And so they basically rounded up everybody they had in custody, which included Jews, political prisoners, policemen, members of the resistance, and they were all killed in reprisal. And Kappler, because he had Talamo in custody, well, this is a good excuse to get rid of that bloke as well. And all of these people were taken to the Ardeatine Caves, which are an underground catacomb in Rome. And all these prisoners were taken in there and they were shot in there. It's a notorious late war massacre by the Germans.
It becomes infamous, doesn't it?
It becomes infamous. But unfortunately, Talamo was a victim of that.
Oh, he was, right.
Yes, he was added to the list by Kappler because Kappler wanted his revenge on him. And he happened to be in custody at the time, so we went, right, add his name to the list, we'll get rid of him. So he was killed. The Costantini brothers,
right,
who had spent all their time in the British Embassy, Secondo Costantini lost his job in the British Embassy in 1940 when the embassy was closed. However, if you close your embassy, quite often countries will have what they call an interest section in someone else's embassy. So you put people, like when Britain didn't have diplomatic relations with Libya back in the 80s and 90s, there was a British interest section in the Libyan embassy in Rome. When I went to Libya, I had to apply for a visa via Rome because there wasn't the embassy in London.
All right.
So the British had a few diplomats. They had a British interest section in the Swiss legation in Rome. And Secondo simply went and worked there instead and carries on supplying intelligence to the Italians and to the Soviets and presumably making money. Neither Secondo nor Francesco Costantini suffered any ill consequences at the end of the war. Actually, on the contrary, Secundo was paid a pension by the SIM in gratitude for his work. There was a question about his links to Soviets, but it's interesting that the MI5 investigation into his links with the Soviets basically cleared him. That investigation was carried out by Anthony Blunt.
Oh, well, I wonder why he was cleared then.
So he lived happily ever after on his SIM pension.
So get him investigated by one of the Cambridge Five.
Brilliant. Exactly. Francesco, on the other hand, made his living after the war breeding tropical fish.
I can think of no better way of ending this podcast.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.